This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A nighttime excursion to measure the health of McLean County's owl population turns up a couple of hoots, but also some concerns.
We know that some of these nocturnal birds are in trouble.
ISU biologist Angelo Caparella talks with Judy Valente about why some nighttime birds are disappearing. Laura Kennedy and Sound Ideas culture maven Sherry Zeck lament the passing of the shopping mall. And Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner talks about a housing project that was tabled, a city transportation commission, and redevelopment of the former Bloomington High School. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's June 13th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
The Bloomington City Council tabled a proposal for a housing development that could include some low-income housing on the city's west side, created a transportation commission, and took the first steps to creating a TIF district to enable redevelopment of the former Bloomington High School. In the studio to talk about last night's really long meeting is Mayor Terry Renner. Mayor, thanks for joining us on Sound Ideas.
Thanks.
We appreciate
Great to be
it,
here.
Especially after a late night. Before we get started, transit and bikes could come up in today's conversation. In the interest of full disclosure, I'm the acting chair of the Connect Transit Board of Trustees and a founding member of the bicycle advocacy organization Bike Blono. Terry, what are your concerns about the annexation and the housing development proposed for Greenwood Avenue? This is essentially a Veterans Parkway frontage road west of Main Street.
Right. Well, my concerns are some of the same that the city council mentioned last night and some people who came by, you know, for public comment. And that is, it is a 54-unit structure. And it is currently not in the city of Bloomington, so that's why we would have had to annex it and then provide services. The developer seems very, very responsible. It is a joint agreement with the Bloomington Housing Authority. 10 would be of the 54 would be reserved for low-income residents, and 10 for those who were disabled. And so on paper, it looks like a great project. It is this the location, though, for it? So we're trying to figure out an impact analysis on Unit 5, financial impact analysis on the city, perhaps even with Connect Transit. And so we want to get an idea of what's going on before we go ahead and commit to annex this and move ahead with this project.
You heard from Unit 5 Council Kurt Richardson, a retired teacher volunteer for Unit 5 and the head of the Cedar Ridge PTO, about the potential stress this development could put on the school district. Here's what Richardson had to say.
Cedar Ridge Elementary School, which is currently the zone school for this proposed development, already has the highest free and reduced rate of students of any school in Unit 5. Currently, the rate of free and reduced students at Cedar Ridge is 76%. And if this proposed development happens, it will almost certainly increase that rate to well over 80%. Thereby increasing the disparity between Unit 5 schools. Along with the increase in poverty comes additional challenges for our students in our school, with additional resources needed to address academic and social-emotional needs.
That's Unit 5 Attorney Kurt Richardson. What was your takeaway from his testimony and others who testified from Unit 5 during the public hearing?
Well, obviously, we certainly appreciate their concerns, and we want to have some more information. I can't imagine that this housing project would increase the figure that he cites from 76 to over 80%. We're talking about 54 units, 34 of them are market rate housing, 10 of them are people who are disabled who may or may not have children. There are only 10 apartments that are designated for low income, and that would be approximately mid-40s, $46,000, $47,000 or less. So, but obviously we want to get some information. We want to get some data. There is another option, and that is you could, essentially send those students, redraw some of the lines, send the students to Benjamin elementary school. So there are lots of options that are on the table, and we want to get more information. So this has been postponed until no later than September 25th. It probably will not take us that long to get all the information that's necessary.
You mentioned the financial impact analysis. City Manager David Hales made that point last night. And he cited the comprehensive plan, and he also talked about how some other annexations have worked out. The Grove, Pepper Ridge. What do you think about moving forward on a financial impact analysis?
Oh, I think that's essential. We need to be doing that. I think they cited roughly the figure was that we spent 20-some million dollars on the Grove and the Cedar Ridge, and I believe that our return was something like $2 million. At least at this point. So we should be looking at a financial impact analysis, and that is surrounded by the city. This isn't like extending four or five miles.
It is sort of infill.
It is sort of right. I think it is definitely infill, except for the fact it's not technically
not
in the city.
Not in the city.
Right. What will the effect be on 911 service, on sewers, on other things? Because new growth should pay for itself. And unless there's some real reason why we have a strategic property that we want to leverage some sort of investment in.
This is Sound Ideas. The community's mayors join us most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings. You're hearing from Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. The city started the ball rolling on a TIF, or a tax increment finance district, to encompass part of an area just east of downtown on Washington. A developer is eyeing the former Bloomington Junior High School on the corner of McLean and Washington. What's the developer have planned, and how will a TIF district help?
Okay. Well, essentially, it's senior affordable housing. And it's a senior living. There'd be first floor would be light retail, but it is, let's face it, this is a great old historic building we don't want to lose. It looks great, or at least in good shape from the outside. There are many places inside that are deteriorating. And so I'm glad this is an exciting project. A TIF district is where money would be set aside from the additional real estate taxes that need to be paid by the owners when the project is complete. So there's not a penny that we currently have in our budget that was going to go for this. We also thought that it would be useful to include some of the surrounding areas. It's still very tight, and this is, we're trying surgical TIFs, and to see whether or not we can encourage investment in the old Coachman property and some other areas.
There are some other surgical TIFs in the community, downtown, north of downtown. Is there a limit to how many TIFs you can do, and are you getting close to that line?
No, I don't believe that there's any legal limit. There may be practical political
limits. And that's what I was referencing.
And the only one that's not, doesn't appear to be surgical, is the Empire Crossing TIF district. And that goes, of course, from Empire Crossing all the way, including the old post office, the shopping center where Heartland Community College started, and the junior high and high school buildings. And that's so that we can help our District 87 partners as new revenues are generated.
Anything happening with those TIF districts, the one that encompasses the front and center building in downtown Bloomington, or the one that includes the former Electrolux Mennonite Hospital building at the corner of Walnut and Main?
There's still quite a bit of
interest.
Well, there's interest in revamping it. Some of that I can't talk about that is in the front and center building. I can tell you that the Electrolux site, we are trying to get out a request for proposals, an RFP, to see who might do what type of projects in that area. We have effective control over that, which is sometimes a serious problem. That's the problem we have, of course, in front and center building. But there are a lot of projects that are out, and we are making lots of progress. We're meeting next week with the library board, joint meeting, to talk about the area south of the library. There are a lot of exciting projects that we're working on to make Bloomington not just a better place to live, work, and play, but also to grow our local economy.
That's Mayor Terry Renner. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The city will soon have a new transportation commission in place. How do you envision this working with city staff and the council?
I think it's going to be very similar to the current STAC committee, but except that the current STAC committee is composed of staff, and there is no formal process for public comment. There are not necessarily minutes that are kept of the meeting. So this is where citizens will function like they do in other boards and commissions and get advice and work with staff, interface with our engineers and Jim Carson, Director of Public Works. So I think this is an important movement in transparency. I mean, we do have an A+ from the Illinois Policy Institute, but these are the types of things that we still can do to improve openness?
The staff liaison for this commission would be the traffic engineer. That position
Correct.
Is new and vacant. What's the timeline for hiring a traffic engineer?
I don't know the details of it, but I know that we're in the process.
It's budgeted.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It's budgeted. So, I don't know whether we're going to have somebody in 6 weeks or in 2 months.
Yeah, okay.
But we're definitely, it's not only in the budget, but the process has begun.
One alderman seemed to express that this was another level of unnecessary bureaucracy and voted against it. Why not have these issues come directly before the council?
Well, because there are quite a few issues. It's one of the reasons why we have a planning commission, we have a zoning commission, so that we have people from all walks of life to bring in their perspective and their opinion. Those aren't binding on the council, but they're advisory. And now some cases, like zoning, and we ran into this last night, if the zoning board recommends something, it takes a two-thirds supermajority on the council to overturn it. So we are looking for people to get involved, to give us their opinion, to specialize in a particular area. And so I disagree, and I'm signing the documents. I supported this. Amelia Burgess has shown great leadership on this.
And here's what Alderman Scott Black had to say about the Transportation Commission.
As we start thinking multimodal and we start thinking about groups of people who may not always have a car, and I can't help but think about the period of time in which I did not have a car and had to go ride my bike everywhere and take the bus. And I learned and saw a group of people that I didn't know existed because you get in your car and you go from A to B. And whether it's by choice or by circumstance, we represent everybody. And it's incumbent upon us to engage the most people in as many ways as possible. So for me, this is a good starting place. We can tweak as we move forward. And I think that we've spoken to a lot of the concerns that the council has raised. And I'm very much looking forward to voting for this and getting it started.
Ward 7 Alderman Scott Black, what's your reaction to that?
I absolutely agree with him. Couldn't agree more. And actually, when one of the Michael Gorman, who's one of our boards and commissions, took me on a trip during Christmas rush hour throughout the city, and I talked with people who are riding Connect Transit buses, and most of them use it every day. Most of it's essential for them, and they don't have access to a car.
And your timeline to appoint this commission?
I need to get my act together fast. I've got lots of people who are
interested.
Are interested. I've gotten lots of applications, but I do want to create some reasonable balance in the seven people. And there is one person who's a civil engineer who I won't mention because I don't know that he's going to say yes. But it'd be nice to have somebody who's a civil engineer and a variety of people who don't have cars, perhaps, as well as people who are pedestrians. Again, people who understand what we mean with complete streets. And I think a variety of perspectives is just what's really, really essential. We're going to make our city a multimodal city. We just are going to have some obstacles getting there.
Mayor Terry Renner, he's the mayor of Bloomington. Terry, thanks for your time on Sound Ideas.
Thank
as
you
always.
So much, Mike.
Bloomington Normal's mayor stopped by Sound Ideas most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings. Next week, you'll hear from Town of Normal Mayor Chris Coos. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Coming up, GLT's Laura Kennedy and culture maven Sherry Zeck lament the slow decline of the shopping mall. That's still to come during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Some familiar bird sounds of the summer night are fast disappearing in central Illinois. That's why local bird watchers are participating in an official count of certain kinds of nocturnal birds, including owls. Once five different owls were common in this area, now two of those owls are on the state's threatened and endangered list because they've lost so much habitat. GLT's Judy Valente goes on the lookout for nighttime birds with Angelo Caparella and Gavin Harper, two biologists and longtime members of the local John Wesley Powell Audubon Society.
It's a perfect night to watch for nocturnal birds, calm winds, clear sky, and a waxing moon just above the horizon. I'm standing on the Lexington Blacktop, just east of Lake Bloomington. I'm with Angelo Caparella of the Biology Department at Illinois State University, and Given Harper, another avid bird watcher and professor at Illinois Wesleyan. We're on the prowl for owls as part of a nocturnal bird count Caparilla is conducting.
Most of the regular counts that we do, such as the spring bird count and the Christmas bird count, doesn't really capture these nocturnal birds. And we know that some of these nocturnal birds are in trouble.
The owl count actually began because of another nocturnal bird. People who live out in the country stopped hearing a familiar nighttime sound, the plaintive call of the whippoorwill, heard here on an American Bird Conservancy recording.
Older folks probably remember hearing these, and they're very hard to hear now. Their populations throughout the Midwest have been collapsing, and that was part of the impetus for establishing this monitoring network across the state of Illinois to try to track population trends, because we may eventually have to list it as an endangered species, even though it once was incredibly common and a typical sound of the summer nights.
The whippoorwill will literally say its name.
It's an onomatopoeia in that it actually says whippoorwill, although it is its own little dialect.
What caused the whippoorwills to go away? For one thing, habitat loss. Maple trees taking over forest areas that once held mostly oak and hickory trees that whippoorwills happen to like.
To be honest, we've been sterilizing the Midwest by spraying pesticides everywhere, and the collapse of their food supply, that is moths, is pretty evident. If you ever remember how moths were so common around our streetlights in the past, it's hard to find that anymore.
Concern over the whippoorwill led state wildlife officials to want to look at the owl population as well. The three main kinds of owls in McLean County are the barred owl, the great horned owl, and the screech owl. They seem to be doing better than the whippoorwill because owls eat both mammals and insects, so they have a larger meal base. But there are some warning signs.
We know that things can happen with them as well. When West Nile came here around 2000 or 2001, the great horned owls were heavily affected and really had a decline in population. But we don't know by how much and how well they've recovered because we don't really have data from that time.
Now we're here with Dr. Given Harper of Illinois Wesleyan, another great bird watcher. Dr. Harper, what exactly are we going to do tonight?
Well, we have 10 stops that we make. We stop for 6 minutes and listen without playing any recordings and record all species that we hear. Then we'll play a screech owl call and listen for 2 minutes, and then we'll also play a barn owl call and listen for 2 minutes. But we only play the barn owl calls if we're not close to someone's house.
Why is that?
They have a really frightening, a hissing scream, and we just have decided we'll only do that when we're some distance away from homes.
I see what Harper means just as soon as he plays the barn owl call. The sound effect for many a horror film or Halloween tape. Do you play the barn owl screech to see if you get a response back?
Yes, because they will perceive the call as a territorial intrusion, and they'll come in and inspect, and oftentimes they'll call back.
So I'm going to start the first minute after these cars pass us.
Busy road here for just a blacktop, a country blacktop.
One thing we really notice is the amount of noise pollution that humans create, because it is when you're really trying to focus on the natural world, it is really obvious.
Caparella and Harper say we're likely not only to hear owls tonight, but we might see one or two of them.
One night I was doing the screech owl call and one landed at my feet on the road, which really freaked both of us out.
Caparella takes out his iPod and broadcasts the screech owl call. What comes next is several minutes of listening.
There are two juvenile great horned owls that are giving begging calls.
I hear nothing of their calls. He says he can detect the sounds because he has been listening for owl calls all of his life. Sometimes Harper will improvise an owl call himself if he thinks he hears one in the distance.
Ooh, 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 ooh.
Owls are astonishing creatures. They have asymmetrical ears, so they can locate sounds in different dimensions. They do have good eyesight, but their eyes can't move in their sockets, which is why they move their heads around so much. They are outstanding hunters. Unfortunately, the great horned owl will feast on other owls, too. After about 2 hours of watching and waiting, as the wind picks up and the temperature drops, we finally actually see our first owl of the night, an adult barred owl. It swoops by a few feet overhead so quickly, like a piece of black drapery soaring on the wind, that I don't have time to record the sound. But this is how the barred owl normally sounds. It's about 11 p.m., and the three of us are tired and ready to go home. The total number of owls we've heard this evening? 10, encompassing three of the five species once common to the Midwest. Based on just that night's count, Caparella and Harper declare the state of at least those three kinds of owls to be in pretty good shape in McLean County.
One can't really go by just a single night, but this was a pretty good run. I would say tonight was definitely one of our better ones, a real fun one, especially since we had all three species.
Be assured, on the next clear night of a nearly full moon, these two intrepid bird watchers will be out once again, playing their owl calls and hoping for a close-up glimpse of these ghostly night prowlers. And they keep hoping they'll also hear the song of the elusive whippoorwill. I'm Judy Valente.
After that evening, another pair of bird watchers reported hearing an adult whippoorwill singing near the Merwin Nature Preserve in Livingston County. Unfortunately, the bird only seemed to be passing through the area rather than to stop here and breed. It's Sound Ideas. Sound Ideas, I'm Mike McCurdy. What was once a ubiquitous part of American consumer culture now seems to be sliding toward extinction. A recent study suggests 15% of traditional shopping malls will disappear in the next decade. GLT's culture maven says when we lose the malls, we may lose something more than just a collection of shops. Laura Kennedy has more.
Macy's is gone. So's The Gap, Radio Shack, The Limited, MC Sports. And soon, Penny's will join the exodus from Eastland Mall in Bloomington. But Eastland is hardly unique. Across the country, malls are dying bit by bit, store by store. Or if they're not dying, at least they're not feeling very well. Nearly a quarter of the malls in the U.S. are at high risk of losing an anchor store. As consumers go elsewhere, like online, to shop, stores close and jobs and revenue vanish. It was just a few decades ago that the mall ruled as a place to shop, to eat, to see a movie. Sherry Zeck, interim dean of Illinois State University's Milner Library and GLT's culture maven, says for 50 years, malls have been a mecca for consumer culture and more.
It was a place to drop off your kids for the day. In their heyday, they were considered safe places for kids to roam, so folks would drop off their kids and go do whatever they do. It was also a place for families to do things together. The malls were really, I think, in many ways, owned by the teens, particularly teens who couldn't drive yet. Uh-huh. So they didn't have true mobility, but they, perhaps a little bit later than my generation, they had a little money in their pockets. And they could meet, they could roam, they could eat, they could buy stuff, they could play in arcades, they could go to the movies. Let's not forget that during the heyday of mall culture, that was also the primary place to go to a movie. So it was a whole entertainment package, and it really was shopping as entertainment.
Well, as a Gen X latchkey kid myself, mm-hmm. I spent many a Saturday dropped off at the mall mm-hmm. and left on my own. Do you think maybe the fact that the Gen X is getting older and, you know, our generation doesn't feel like we could drop our kids at the mall, that that might be contributing to the change of what the mall means to us?
Well, that's a good thought. I do think that we live in an era where folks are more cautious about anonymous crowds. and where people are certainly more cautious about leaving their children unsupervised. I don't know so much about teenagers, but we're in a more fearful culture. Though I think fundamentally the shift away from mall culture is about other cultural dynamics. Certainly in the last 10 years, it's the availability of product online. But there's also there's been something else going on. And from the 70s, when it was all about the convenience of a particular location, an interior location. You know, we talk about teenagers, but there's also a lot of old folks who go to the mall to walk, to get exercise. But to have a place where they were comfortable in terms of climate and relative ease of access and all of those kinds of things, to now when people go out for a shopping day, they want a little bit better food. They like outside spots. So you go to newer strip malls, what I would still call strip malls, but they're not really strip malls, shopping areas in the suburbs. And there will be coffee shops that have some outdoor seating. There's convenient parking, but there's sort of an attempt to make it feel like a neighborhood, like you're entering a little neighborhood that you walk around in, but not too far. Parking's got to be convenient.
Mm-hmm.
That have, yes, some anchor stores, but also some specialty stores. So I think it's a difference in how people want to shop specifically. Also, there are other options, many more options for where young people, not adult shoppers, but for where young people can and do go for their entertainment. Certainly.
And that's right in the palm of their hand on their phone.
Well, they can sit on their couch, yes, and not go anywhere for entertainment and chat with their friends and Snapchat and whatever else.
We don't have to be physically together to be together now.
That's exactly right. I mean, well, for me, certainly, when the first mall appeared in my life in, I don't know, probably when I was 13 or so, perhaps a little bit younger, which was a long, long time ago, it was certainly an event to go to the mall. And it was absolutely about hanging out with friends and feeling freedom, not freedom. It was an expansion of our universe, but in a very controlled way.
When malls became popular, people would say, oh, well, this is the new town square. Was it really the town square for us?
No, it wasn't a new community. It was a new amusement park of some sort. That's different.
At the Mall of America, literally.
Literally the Mall of America, and it was all about consumerism. It's always dangerous to invoke a movie that is beloved by many people but not so much by yourself. But I'm going to mention the Blues Brothers. And in my view, the greatest scene in the Blues Brothers is when they crash through the mall.
It's pants and burgers.
Yeah, lots of space in this mall. Baby clothes.
This place has got everything.
And so the mall was pretty soon after its inception, as much as it was a place for people to go and shop and in some sense gather, it was also reviled as the height of trashy American consumerism.
People looked down their nose at the mall.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So some of the sort of new shopping experiences that aren't online are about being classier in some way and really trying to create this feeling of neighborhood and one area being distinct from another in terms of its walking paths and the kinds of flowers that are planted and the style of the buildings and that sort of thing.
Well, speaking of people who are looking down on the mall, maybe George Romero felt that way in Dawn of the Dead, which, you know, he had zombies taking over a mall. And I think it's interesting because the zombies apparently were congregating at the mall because that's what they were used to doing.
Most of the gates are down. I don't think they can get into the stores.
I haven't seen any of them up on the second floor.
Big department stores usually use both floors.
Then we can get in up top.
What are they doing? Why did they come here?
Some kind of instinct, memory, what they used to do. This was an important place in their lives.
But was Romero making a comment on malls in our society in that film?
Oh, absolutely. But like I say, malls are, from their inception, really, they were equally delighted in for their various conveniences and the pleasures of consumerism. And that's where we'd go see movies. I mean, I can't minimize that enough. That was a huge part of the draw to malls and of shifting viewing patterns of people interested in cinema in this culture. But at the same time, they were so blatantly pans to consumerism and really the trashiest parts of American culture, the most blatantly greedy and money-oriented and thing-oriented and acquisition-oriented sort of structures that we inhabited that filmmakers and comedians and others attack them in many different forms.
What are we losing when we start to lose traditional malls and they start shutting down in communities?
I don't think you can separate this from the loss in general of the brick-and-mortar store, right? So I think what we're losing in malls specifically is more importantly about what we're losing in terms of local income, local jobs, and taxes and all of those kinds of things. I think that's the real problem with losing the mall, and also because those very large businesses that have been standards of not just consumerism, but the access to products for decades and decades and decades, such as Sears and others, in losing that storefront income, they're also going under. Now, with that, in terms of malls specifically, let's go back. Let's forget teenagers for a moment. Let's go back to old people. So you are an older person and you need to get some exercise, but it's particularly dangerous for you to be out in the cold, the wet, icy streets. Where do you go for that exercise? If you can't afford a health club, where do you go for that exercise? Where do you go to be able to walk around with your friends and have a comfortable place to sit and some place to eat and yet also get the mobility that every study on the planet shows us that we need even and especially as we get older for both our physical and mental health. So I worry about the destruction of these large interior spaces, whether they are commercial and consumerist or not. The destruction of those kinds of spaces I think actually will have health effects that we haven't really anticipated, particularly for those people who are not sufficiently affluent to join health clubs and who don't have access to senior centers that have robust facilities and that sort of thing.
With so many malls dying off, there's almost a sort of a genre or a subgenre of photography that seems to be coming to the fore, dead malls. People going, mm-hmm. photographers going into malls and photographing what was once a thriving, vibrant part of the community. And then you just see these empty spaces. And I'm almost like, it's like dead mall porn, looking at these photographs. And you can imagine how they once were. And you see what they've become. And it's like looking at the remnants of an ancient civilization gone to ruin.
Yes. Well, it used to be photographs of small town America. And before that, it was the West. And before that, it was
dead downtowns.
I don't know, Greece
we had
or
dead,
something.
Yeah, exactly.
But you're right. But what is so interesting in that in particular is how quickly this has happened. I mean, it feels like the move toward destruction and decay and things being remnants of the past is happening in a much more accelerated fashion, right? We're not talking about photographs of outposts in the Old West that were constructed in the early 1800s that then were abandoned by the 1880s or something. We're talking about within a span of 40 or 50 years, something that's gone from non-existence to abandonment and decay. That's really pretty astounding.
Is it a little disturbing to you?
It's very disturbing to me, yeah.
What does it say about us?
Well, for one thing, I think it says something about the quality of construction, right?
Yes.
Seriously, I think it's something about the quality of construction that has changed. There is something about that, but I think it's more about the quickness with which our culture abandons things. And sadly, I think that is also reflected in the way we abandon each other. So there's such an incredible instability about what we hold on to and what we value. Some would say this makes the future exciting. I think it makes it kind of scary. It feels grotesque to be sit here mourning the loss of this incredible homage to retail, mm-hmm. to the gluttony of American consumerism. That seems just a little bit ridiculous, but it seems to me as a culture, we have this incredible desire to not get out of our chair, right? So on the one hand, there's been this move toward more and more sedentary life, right? The remote control. I mean, God forbid you would get up and cross the room
to change the channel.
But now, God forbid you would get up and cross the room every 2 hours to change the movie. I can tell you myself, I have a two-floor house, and I have 2,500 CDs. But if I'm hankering to listen to one song, I'm just as likely to buy it for 99 cents. I know, I haven't entered the Spotify world.
Instead of going upstairs,
finding the CD, bringing it down, putting it – that's crazy. But I'm pretty sure I'm not alone in that sort of thing. On the other hand, everything else in our culture is about mobility. We want to be able to take our whole computing life with us and hold it in the palm of our hand. Certainly nothing is diminished about car culture. One of the hottest topics, as it should be, in communities is about how to get people from one place to another. When we talk about getting social services to people who need them, often the biggest chunk of it is not getting a dentist to volunteer his or her time. It's how do you get the people from the poorer part of town to the dentist? How do you get them away from their jobs to go to the dentist? That sort of thing. So we live in a town that has hundreds of parking spaces, and yet the number one complaint you hear about our town is there's no parking. Well, there's plenty of it. It's just not 10 feet in front of the store.
Right.
It's a block away. A block away. So this tension we have in which we really want things to be close and immediate, and yet we want total mobility. And to me, it sort of seems like the mall answers that tension, and yet we want it gone, or we have moved away from that.
That's Sherry Zeck, interim dean of Illinois State University's Milner Library and GLT's Culture Maven. I'm Laura Kennedy.
In case you were wondering, the mall the Blues Brothers crashed through in the 1980 film recently met the wrecking ball for real. The Dixie Square Mall in Harvey, Illinois was officially demolished in 2012. You're listening to Valley of the Malls, Fountains of Wayne on Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, building relationships while supporting and serving the community. Justin offers life insurance options designed to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
An Illinois State University scholar has won one of the most prestigious awards in children's literature. Roberta Trites is a Brothers Grimm honoree for her analysis and criticism in the field. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with Trites about the award and her forthcoming book. The award is only given every couple of years. It began in 1986.
This was created on the centenary of the Brothers Grimm, and that's why it's named for them. And it really was designed to recognize the emergence of a growing field and the legitimacy of studying books written for children as a field of literary study.
You have lobbied for, championed the idea of international consideration of different children's literature works. Is that something that still needs further attention, or is it time to move on to a transnational, comparative kind of approach to children's literature? What's the trend?
Folklorists have been doing transnational work since the 80s. They really have. So we have a model in place for that. I'm still concerned that in the United States, the vast majority of books that we get and then our children read were published in the United States by U.S. authors. And I do believe we live in a world that's internationalizing and needs to. So I will continue to advocate for more books from other countries to be made accessible to children in this country.
What does that bring? Give a couple examples of the kinds of cultural broadening epiphanies that can happen with a work from another country.
The Danes have some beautiful novels that problematize things like childhood darkness, that the way children can turn on each other and even enact each other's deaths. They have some very poignant stories coming out of Sweden. The Japanese have extraordinary tales of loss and grief and recovery. American children, U.S. children's literature tends to focus on the optimistic, the upbeat, and the happy. It's a legacy of our romantic construction of childhood. We still want children to be protected, and we still view children as innocent. And yet, if we protect children too much, we don't teach them resilience. We don't teach them how to deal with their own inevitable negative emotions, because no one can make it through life without experiencing grief. So especially the Scandinavians and the Japanese do a remarkable job of preparing children for emotional resilience, not just happy endings.
What can the African nations teach us?
We had a Fulbright scholar here from Tanzania, and what we learned from her was the paucity of children's publishing. She brought to us the books that are published for children in Tanzania, which is one of the more economically advanced countries in terms of children's literacy. And they were essentially stapled together paperbacks that looked almost like they'd been run by a mimeograph machine. It was startling. What the African nations can teach us is the importance of literacy, the deep, deep foundation of folklore and how it affects people emotionally still, the importance of the oral tradition. But it also reminds us of our privilege.
Now, let's talk about the oral tradition. Is the Brothers Grimm started out taking from the oral tradition and writing it down? And in children's literature, I think there is still that sensibility. Is that true, and is it carried out in other countries as well?
I'll take your question about the Grimms, which, because they were so influential both in Europe and in North America. What the Grimms did effectively was collect the tales of many, many people, primarily women, and they gave them a structured order. Their goal was to help create a sense of German nationalism at the time. They did erase the names of all the women whose stories they borrowed, which concerns some scholars. But in systematizing these stories, they also created tropes that we still see in our children's novels across the world, not just in the U.S., Canada, and Europe. And we see tropes like the child leaving home and returning home, a home-away-home pattern, we call it. And you see it, for example, in Hansel and Gretel. We see tropes of death and resurrection, as we see when Little Red Riding Hood is swallowed by a wolf, but then she rises again, just like Harry Potter does. We see tropes of eating and being eaten. Again, Hansel and Gretel come to mind. And we see tropes of the magic number of three. There's a lot of speculation about why three is a magic number in fairy tales, but perhaps the easiest explanation is it's a narrative structure. One pig makes a bad house. Another pig makes a bad house. Oh, we have a pattern. And now a third pig breaks the pattern, and things go better.
Well, the triadic approach is common in Celtic lands. It's common in a lot of things. We go from Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, to Father, right. Son, and Holy Ghost, to yesterday, today, to tomorrow. We go to Moeller and Curly, you know.
Right.
It's a human thing. It's not just a literature thing.
No, it's absolutely not. But I think the Grimm's brothers were instrumental in moving that from, in their culture, a biblical triad into a narrative triad for children to understand structural patterns.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Roberta Treitz, the International Brothers Grimm Award winner this year. It's an award that's given only every couple of years and is a singular honor in the field of children's literature. You have a forthcoming book out from the University Press of Mississippi, 21st Century Feminisms in Children's and Adolescent Literature. Tell us about that.
Most of the last 20 years of children's literature, even 30 years of children's literature scholarship, was very focused on gaining legitimacy within the field. And so scholars were very much following the trends, the wider trends in literary criticism, especially focusing on issues of discourse and subject formation, issues of narrative structure, issues that involve and prioritize language. We did this very much to say this field is as legitimate a field of study as any other. But in the process, we forget that there's a material body. Children are physically embodied in a different way than adults. There are physical changes that occur in the transition from childhood to adulthood, specifically puberty. And in ignoring the material embodiment of the child, our field might have done a disservice to actual children. So I'm offering my book as a corrective, one that says, yes, the discursive is important. How we think about language and how it shapes our perceptions, we can't avoid that. But we also have to pay attention to materiality. We have to pay attention to the physical world of the child.
How should that be done? How should your objects of study change as a result of this sensibility?
What we're asking and inviting scholars, those of us who are in the material turn, as it's called, what we're inviting other scholars to do is to look at the intra-activity between the material and the discourse that shapes it. One of my graduate students recently did a nice paper on food. We think of food as an inanimate object, and yet when we eat it, it takes on agency. It gives us energy. It transforms itself. So, and we joke that, yes, food speaks to me. That chocolate donut is calling my name right now. We have an unusual relationship with food. Rather than focusing, as we have in the past, on the child as the agent who eats the food, what we're asking is for people to recognize that inanimate objects have a certain type of agency that also affects the child. Another famous example is Hurricane Katrina. There are several beautiful children's books written about it. Hurricane Katrina was a natural disaster that was made worse by man-made forces. And Hurricane Katrina had very strong material effects on people throughout that region and even throughout the country. So we're asking instead of thinking of language as that which shapes our experience, we're asking for people to understand that the material experiences of the environment, of technology, of inanimate objects, of the weather, that has an agency in the child's life as well.
And how do those experiences of a hurricane shift with the age of the child?
That's a very good question. Children who are too young to understand a force like Katrina might understand it better through metaphors of magic. They might understand better that there are certain things that we can't always understand. I want to go back to the Harry Potter books. For younger children, it's very, very hard to talk about the Holocaust. It's very hard to talk about the systematic anti-Semitism that led to an entire nation being, not an entire nation, but too many people in a nation being willing to ignore what was happening to people who were marginalized. I'm not sure I want to sit down and scare 7, 8, 9-year-olds with a story about mass genocide and with a story about horrible, horrible discrimination. So if I don't want to do that, if I want to slowly teach a child about the terrors of life, I can use children's literature as a metaphor. And instead of talking about the Aryan race, I can talk about purebloods in Harry Potter, and I can talk about muggles, and I can talk about half-bloods, and I can point out that discrimination happens in a way that might be cognitively easier for some children to understand.
Tell us more about how you construct your argument in the book.
One of the first things I do is look at eco-criticism and how children interact with the environment. I have another chapter that involves sexuality and how the sexual experience of coming up of age into sexuality is an embodied experience. I have a chapter on the dystopic in which I really look at how the human body is depicted, especially the female body, in dystopias where girls are often marked on their skin by scars or implants under their skin.
And it's not just girls, though, in dystopias. The body reflects the society in that way.
That's right. My focus is on girls because I think feminism has shifted its message. It has shifted away from a 1980s message of we're not paying attention to girls enough. It's shifted to the next phase of girls and boys are equal, to now a phase where we're saying the embodiment of the female is a different and important thing to recognize. Whether you're trans female or you're cis female, that how other people treat your body is part of your experience of selfhood. And finally, I conclude with an ethics of care chapter influenced by one of my colleagues in the English department. And I talk about probably the most important gesture that's happening as we talk about embodiment is a recognition that we must all be interconnected through caring for each other, for the child's body, that truly feminist behavior is always about equality and caring and parity and not about who's superior, who's stronger. It's always about caring.
ISU Children's Literature Scholar Roberta Trites speaking with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. Trites says she's overwhelmed and astounded by receiving the Brothers Grimm Award. She'll accept it and make a presentation in Osaka, Japan this fall. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas. On WGLT Normal, find Judy Valente's Owl Count Excursion at WGLT.org, along with other individual interviews and the full show podcast at our website. Tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLTFM.